When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello.
Hello.
Got a bone to pick with you?
No.
Yeah.
Not with me.
With you, Ed. I'm sorry. So last week's episode, Reasons to be Icelandic.
Great episode.
Got a great episode, great response. Yeah. We said in advance we were going to put out a video of you and I luxuriating in a geothermal hot pool to promote the episode.
Yeah.
And you suppressed the tape.
My staff, I think.
You've suppressed it.
Too much chest hair.
We had a very clear rule that there were no nipples. I made sure to keep my nipples beneath the water's surface.
You need to have a word with Lindsay in my office. She vetoed it.
What is it? Is it your chest hair that the problem? Could we not pixelate your chest hair?
I think it was generally thought to be sort of...
Is it the case that the country is falling to pieces and having a video of you
perhaps
in the bath with me perhaps isn't not quite the right note that you want to strike?
It's those political insights that you get the big bucks for, I think.
I think maybe
as a Christmas present.
I understand. Well, you said that about the trampoline video, and we've never seen that.
Do you think
yet?
We should release a trampoline video?
we should release a compilation.
Yeah, only if you tell me the end of the leisure centre story.
Well, as I've said...
I think that would be disappointing compared to the steam bath and the...
Oh, yeah, the steam bath. I mean, it's really worth seeing. Yeah. I've seen these videos and they're really something. Yeah. I mean, I think it could end up taking on mythical status like Donald Trump's piss tape. I mean, not saying that there was any of that going on in the pool, at least not on my part.
No, me neither.
So if there was enough of a head of steam behind it,
boom.
If there was enough public demand, would you consider at a point when things are perhaps a little less turbulent in the news, releasing the video of you and I in the hot spa?
No.
Then I think we need to we need some kind of inquiry.
You've got no credible threat now, have you?
Well, I think
I've called your bluff.
We could get some kind of judgment to force you to release it.
What, a sort of
get you subpoenaed? Yes.
Well, what about the U.S. Congress?
Yeah, I mean, I'm willing to take it all the way.
You think you might
to the hill?
Yes. I think they might be busy as well.
Well, I'm hoping that if the Reasons to be Cheerful audience can get behind this, and you know, we have a lot of, people would want to get behind.
Demagoguery does not suit you.
It's not becoming.
It's not becoming. Playing to the crowd, demagoguery is unbecoming.
I'm going to leak it. Actually, I can't leak it because it's on your phone, not mine.
Yeah, thank goodness.
Well, we'll see about that. We'll see. Well, that was any other business arising from last week's episode.
Any other business? You sound like a sort of Labour Party meeting. Very professional.
Yeah, I'm very professional when I want to be, despite outward appearances, despite much evidence to the contrary. That was last
week. It
was
a good episode, the Iceland episode, wasn't it?
I very much enjoyed it, and thank you again.
I saw people tweeting in Icelandic about it, actually.
Yeah. I mean, I think it could be very easy for us to become big in Iceland.
Yeah.
This week, then.
Yes.
So this week we are talking about alcohol and our relationship with alcohol in this country. I think you say I've got a personal interest in this because I'm an alcoholic. I've not had a drink for 18 years, but I'm not Puritan about it. I think, you know, if people want to have a drink, have a good time, great. But there is a certain amount of cultural pressure that goes with it. There's massive health concerns that go with the overconsumption of alcohol. And there's also what it does to families, what it can do to relationships. And those are the things we're going to be looking at. We're going to be talking to a historian who has looked at the relationship between Britain and alcohol over hundreds of years. We're going to be talking to somebody from an alcohol charity campaigning against alcohol harm. And we're going to be talking to a colleague of Ed's, John Ashworth, who is the Shadow Secretary of State for Health. But he's also shared, and you may have seen a video of this a while ago, his own experience of how alcohol affected his family, but specifically his father, who was an alcoholic. And he spoke very movingly about this. And as a result of that, actually, cross-party change came.
To be fair, you know, not just him, other MPs, Caroline Flint, Liam Byrne, I think the Conservative George Freeman have also done the same.
So that's what we're talking about on this week's episode.
Now, what's your reason to be cheerful? Because goodness knows we need them at the moment.
My reason to be cheerful is Sarah's been nominated for an award.
Has she?
Chortle is the big comedy website, and she's been nominated for Best Newcomer. This is my wife, Sarah Barron. But it needs public votes. So, I'm on the campaign trail.
When is the deadline?
I think there's a few weeks.
Or do you go to Chortle dot?
Yeah, and then the comedy awards are in. There's all these different categories.
Right. Vote for Sarah Barron. Yeah. She's really funny.
Yes, I mean, and I have to say, if it was a choice between you campaigning to get Ed to release a video of us in the hot spa, or
vote for Sarah, then choose Sarah Barron, definitely.
Not sure that's
no.
The way
she's
I was
honestly
go.
So funny. Yeah, as so, I said to you before.
Yeah, if you're idling around online and you fancy casting a vote,
yeah,
helps the family business.
No, indeed.
So that's mine. What's yours?
I was going to say she's the funny version of the Barron Lloyd duo, but that's be mean. And I wouldn't mean it. She's even funnier than you, and you're incredibly funny.
Oh, come on,
and handsome, and suave, and sophisticated.
What's your reason to be cheerful?
My reason to be cheerful is I am now officially part of a WhatsApp group.
There is a new Reasons to be cheerful admin WhatsApp group, yep. And you've been included in it this time.
I know. I'm really grateful I've not been excluded. I am getting slightly fed up of all the messages. So
you were just saying, I think I'm going to leave the group.
But honestly, it's better to have been invited into the group and then choose to leave it than never to have been invited into the group.
I'm not getting into this again with
no,
you.
No, but I promise you, if the next message is Ed Miliband's left the group, I just want to put it on the record, I'm not going to say I was never invited, as happened last time.
You're listening to Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
We're going to talk now to Angela McShane, who is an early modern historian and head of research development at the Wellcome Collection. Angela, hello, and you specialise in the history of intoxicants in the UK.
Yes, I'm interested in material culture of drinking, ritual drinking and political drinking.
Political drinking? Ooh.
Did you do much of that? Have you seen much evidence of that, Ed?
Some Diet Coke, really. Right.
So I think of us as this quite drunken country, and perhaps not with the healthiest attitude towards alcohol. How historically do we fit in with other Western European countries, for example?
Well, we're part of the northern part of Europe, where we tend to use drink separately from food. So that encourages drunkenness, I guess, if you like, because you see drink as a separate part of social activity and indeed, you know, the things that you ingest. Whereas in southern parts of Europe, and this actually works globally, you know, so you can look at north and south in that kind of way, then that tends to be drink with food. So you're thinking of drink as something that is a food, like you know, like bread, like wine, like meat.
So can you look at a country like France and see, okay, if you look at consumption per person in litres,
right,
theirs might be higher, but that's because they're always having a drink with food, whereas with us it might be that we're saving until a Friday night and then we're going to go nuts and really binge on it.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, if you think about the, and I know, the 1940s and 50s, you know, the working man comes home, has his tea, drinks tea with his cooked tea, and then goes out the pub to drink beer with his mates and talk and so on. Whereas in France, your working man has come back from the factory or whatever he's done, the field, and he sits down with his bottle of wine and his family and drinks his wine there. Maybe he goes out to a bar and then will drink liquor. And that's kind of quite interesting. Our tendency, except for the latest rise of gin and cocktails, our tendency is to think of wine and beer as the things that we'll mostly drink. That's historically been mostly the case. Whereas that whole range of much stronger liquors has been part of the practice elsewhere.
And is it not the case that if you go back, I don't know, 150 or a couple of hundred years in history, people were just like a little bit drunk all the time? Like what they drank was sort of weak beer.
Yeah, so small beer and work, was everybody drunk all the time? That's a very common question that's asked of drink historians.
Well, that's what my perception is, that people weren't drinking water in the way that we do now. They were just drinking weak beer all the time.
Well, the first thing is, I think we should myth bust here.
Okay.
People drank water. People didn't have the money to pay for, you know, beer all the time and things like that. But beer was seen as a basic nutrient, a part of your basic diet. So, I mean, in Britain, for example, certainly in England, the poor had the right to buy a quart, so that's 2 pints of beer, for a penny. So every alehouse licensed person had to offer that to the poor. Interestingly, in some cases, you see some court cases where the poor are allowed to buy that, but if they're a bit disreputable looking, they're forced to have it outside. Right. Bearing in mind, it's not hot. Okay. So that is a kind of right, because it's a fundamental nutrient, way of getting nutrients.
Amazing.
Yeah. So wine is much higher end. It's imported because we give up making wine quite early on, and that's seen on one hand as something that you put often in medicines, and then from the late 16th century is increasingly seen as a drink for the better off to have as part of conviviality, sociality. So the real development of the fear about drunkenness being purveying all of society, certainly from the period I'm interested in, which is from about the late 16th century onwards, that really comes in as people are starting to use drink as a sociable, something to use for in sociable situations.
And is that a moral issue? Is that coming from the church? Or I've got it in my head that the Industrial Revolution was a thing that, a bit later than that, was a thing that sort of changed the way that they regulate and think about drink, because they didn't want sort of drunk people operating the looms and machinery the whole time.
Right. Well, the business of government, governmental authorities, because this could be, you know, magistrates, churches, it could be states, has constantly wanted to police the drinking of the poor and the working people and women. So these are the groups that everybody worries about all the time. Not for their health particularly, but because they're all seen as potentially disruptive to society. So we can say in the 16th century, or actually the first act to try and reduce the amount of time you can drink is in 1604. James the First brings in this act that you mustn't tipple, and you're tippling if you stay in an alehouse for longer than, I think it's an hour. And so you can only, so it's the first kind of, legislation to do with drinking hours, if you like. So yes, if you've got your modern head on and you're thinking, oh yes, this comes in as well to prevent, particularly during the wars, actually to prevent workers being drunk when they go back to factories and things like this. This happens a long time before that. And anxieties, particularly about women and how they're drinking, is always seen as a kind of moral gauge for society. So if women are lying in the streets of Nottingham drunk, then this means that all of society has fallen apart and we need to completely change everything.
God, it's
and
like that, how they treated the Ladettes in the 90s.
Well, that is the Ladettes. That's where that story comes from, because the Ladettes emerges from a point in history in the 80s. I'm just writing about this. You know, those of us who are my age, a little older than 40, we remember when...
Borderline millennial, we call it.
we remember a time when a woman couldn't go into a pub and order a pint. You would be given two halves if you were insisting on a pint of beer.
Is that
so
right?
You don't remember that, but I remember that. And I was brought up in a pub. And you know, so women couldn't be given a pint of beer. Now, that kind of seems to commence, I don't know, from somewhere around the 50s or 60s, because they're drinking, you know, they can order a quart of beer, you know, right through the whole early modern period and so on. But they tend to share it with people. People don't actually drink that much. I mean, looking into that, the maximum on a big night out that a woman might drink is half a bottle of wine.
For when?
In the 17th century.
Right.
And then you know the gin craze comes along. You know, what is the picture that Hogarth, irritating man, produces to show what it, you know, the complete society's fallen apart because of gin? He actually shows you women drinking too much, a woman dropping her baby because she's drunk and so on. Actually, that woman isn't drinking gin. She's holding a snuff box. People don't ever notice that. She's not drinking gin. She's taking snuff. She's being luxurious. She's luxuriating in leisure time, in, you know, intoxicating behaviours, and isn't doing what the working class should do, which is to blooming well work,
right,
or have leisure.
So there's a big, for you, there's a big class aspect in this
sort
of moral anxiety about drinking.
Well, when looking in, if you want to go through all the newspapers, how many times do you get the big headline, middle classes drunk at home? You know, doctors drink too much at a party. You don't. You get girls drunk on the street. You know, young people drinking too much. That's what you get. And you get this little snapshot, which is supposed to be speaking for all. And yet we know that young people drink less than they ever did. Alcohol.
What
anyway.
Now?
Yeah. They drink less than they ever did. That's been on the decline for quite a
while.
So
are you more relaxed as a historian about Britain's relationship or British people's relationship with alcohol? What does it, how does it change your perspective on the current, on the present day?
Well, I mean, I see, so I'm particularly interested in political drinking, I said that before. And what I see, I'm particularly interested in ritual drinking that really kicks off during the Civil War. So we think we're divided over Brexit. Welcome to the 17th century. you know, and in that at that time, those who supported the crown, the loser for quite a long time, they would have all these health drinking rituals. OK, and these were actively banned by the Puritan state. So when the monarchy comes back in 1660, they all decide that was a terrible idea, and so they're going to have the monarchy back after all. So they come back in 1660. Drinking healths to the crown becomes embedded in all the great pillars of state, and it's still the case. This is the point that I would highlight. So it is still the case in universities, still the case in the legal profession, still the case in politics, still the case in health. Anywhere where you have major authorities, they will pledge their allegiance to the crown, the state, through drinking alcohol. Now, it's easier now to not do it, but there was a time, the 19th century, where if a soldier had refused to drink health in alcohol, you know, he could have been cashiered. So it's embedded in our whole society. And so it's not just a historic thing. It's actually there all the time. Well, to untangle all that, that's pretty hard to do.
Can I ask you about the British relationship with not drinking?
Ah, yes.
So I'm an alcoholic. I've not had a drink for 18 years. And if people offer me a drink and I say I'm an alcoholic, people are respectful of that.
Yeah.
However, when I was drinking, or I've seen it around other people, if somebody says to them, oh, I don't fancy it tonight, or I'm having a week off, or I'm not drinking tonight, people cannot handle it.
No.
You know, they're respectful of somebody who's got themselves into such a state they can never touch alcohol again. But it seems to me, as a country, we've got this real suspicion of people who just don't want to drink. I don't like it.
Yeah. And I've argued that also emerges out of this same history that I'm talking about. So there's this fantastic song, actually, from the 17th century, and it kind of refers to... Well, there's a whole bunch of songs that are attacking people that don't drink, because if they don't drink, it means they're Puritans, they're anti the crown, they're anti the good fellow, they're anti-society.
What's the song called?
Oh, there's a whole bunch of them. There's a
What's
lot
your favourite?
Of them. So there's one that says, he that drinks with good reason is loyal and something or other. It's a long title. These are not snappy songs.
Don't worry.
there's the delights of the bottle. There's like a whole bunch of them. Right. So I can give you a reference later.
No, it's fine.
We can make a Spotify playlist.
Yeah, exactly.
So there was actually this kind of whole concept of seditious sobriety. That so the sober person is actually seditious. And I don't think that goes away. So when I give sort of like talks, I'm dealing especially with the public, I always ask them, if you're out and somebody says they don't want to drink, how do you feel? And that's exactly what they always say. Well, that's all there's only got to be two reasons. They're on antibiotics or else they're an alcoholic.
We have this thing on the podcast called the Jeffocracy, which is Jeff as the benign ruler. He's obviously got a particular sort of perspective
angle,
on the issue of drinking. But what would you be, if you were his minister for alcohol,
yes.
what would you be telling him he should be doing?
Well, I would be minister for intoxicants, firstly. Can we change that?
Yeah,
history? And secondly, I think that the regulation of the standards of the things that we ingest in our body and kind of the amounts that you can buy that is sensible and then education around all those things, these are the most powerful things to help people to manage intoxicants, but also sugar. Unbelievably bad for most people's health. You know, there's a lot of stuff that we don't manage very well. So I would say regulate everything. Regulate everything, ban nothing. We all learned in prohibition, banning things doesn't work. There are people, you know, we've got alcoholism in my family as well. I got brought up in a... I kind of have a bit of a sense of these things, probably. But, you know, there are people that will have problems with a whole range of things. Some people are allergic to nuts. Some people can't handle alcohol. Some people can't manage other things. That is part of those individual people's health. But the fact is, everybody won't get addicted to everything. And so what we need to do is to be adults about it. And I think that's what we see when we go to Southern Europe and other places, where, incidentally, liver disease is very high. So they also need to think about how they're drinking. You know, that we need to just be adult about it, understand where some of these things come from. Why do I feel like that when somebody tells me they're not going to drink? You know, let's understand it. That's what history is for, so that we can unpick some of those things and find alternatives that work well. So I think the other thing is about this options in a bar. You should walk into a bar and there's a whole range of mocktails, whole fantastic stuff for drinks with different tastes, and there's alcohol and there's coffee. There's all the different things that you can have. Let's stop drawing lines between this kind of behaviour and that kind of behaviour.
Great, you got the job. I look forward to a wide range of mocktails in the Jeffocracy.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. That's been great.
We're delighted to have with us now John Ashworth, who's MP for Leicester South and Shadow Secretary of State for Health and Social Care. Hello, John.
Hello.
And, a long-time colleague of Ed's as well.
Yes, I mean, it's...
Not particularly scarred by it?
I don't think I'm scarred.
You're more scarred by Gordon than by me.
We were both there with Gordon, weren't we?
Yeah,
I was campaigning hard for you.
Yeah. Do you still get 2 o'clock in the morning emails?
I spoke to Gordon last week, in fact.
Actually. 2 o'clock in the morning?
I wasn't at 2 o'clock in the 2 o'clock in the morning. Working in Gordon's team in the Treasury, you'd walk in, and this is the days before BlackBerries and iPhones and so on. So better days in that respect. Yeah. You'd walk into the office and you'd have sort of half a dozen emails from him, which he'd send at sort of 4 a.m. or something.
Yeah. It was also the days I was remembering the other day of pagers. Pagers were really awful, actually. The pagers are much worse than mobile phones, but there's something about pagers. Which was sort of, it was the sort of New Labour attribute of choice in the 1990s. You know what I mean? Or not of choice, maybe.
So it's like being a doctor on call.
It is like being
a doctor on call. But you're a wonk on call. So we're here to talk about alcohol today. And alcohol is something that you have spoken about quite publicly from a personal perspective in over the last couple of years. Can you tell us a little bit more about that to start off?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I'm Labour's Shadow Health Secretary, as you know. And when I got given the job, admittedly, in you know, perhaps controversial or difficult circumstances, coming after a bit of turbulence in the Labour Party, if I can put it like that, I thought that I wanted to use the job as a platform to speak out on some things that I cared about, because it's not unusual for a Labour Shadow Health Secretary to be on the television complaining about the A&E crisis and complaining about people on trolleys and corridors and people waiting longer for an operation. And they are all legitimate complaints. That is happening after 8 or 9 years of austerity in the NHS. But I also thought I wanted to speak about some things which I think I cared about personally and which I think are being neglected in society. And I chose to speak about my own circumstances with my dad, who, to be frank, was an alcoholic. And to not put too fine a point on it, essentially drank himself to death. I'd never spoken about that before publicly, really. My friends knew about it. But it just occurred to me that there's a whole issue here which isn't really talked about in public. People see it as a bit of a taboo. People think alcohol and getting drunk and drinking, I'm not against people getting drunk and having a good time, but people just think it's a funny thing, it's hilarious, it's hey, hail fellow, well met, all that kind of stuff. And my dad was a bit like that. You know, he was always drunk when I was growing up, you know.
So daytime,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah. Oh, I started drinking in the day. I remember being picked up from school once by him and he fell over, he was so drunk. My parents got divorced as a result. It was a broken home because my mum couldn't put up with it any longer, and you know, and who would blame her? I remember going home and opened the fridge as a kid, and you know, and there'd be nothing in there other than bottles of cheap wine and cheap lager. It always sort of coloured my childhood and my upbringing. This,
can I ask, how different did it feel to the upbringing of the kids around you? Were you aware of it at the time?
Well, I suppose that I was aware that my dad was a heavy drinker, although I didn't really understand he was an alcoholic until I become more grown up, more of a teenager and then an adult. Like on all these things, kids, they don't know any different. You sort of get on with it. You don't really appreciate how different it is. And I think for me, it meant I grew up very fast. I mean, I was an only child. So a lot of the times when I was drunk and it was a bit like at the weekends when I was with him, I was almost caring for him. But it got the thing that is, I think, most difficult for me, and this is what I spoke about this in Parliament. It was a debate on alcohol, and I went in with a sort of, you know, written out speech with all the facts and figures on alcohol, and I actually sort of threw it aside and decided just to tell my story instead. And the sort of bit that went viral in this day and age of social media was the bit when I spoke about my wedding when I was a grown-up. And see, my dad decided one day that he was going to go off. He'd had enough of this country, and he went off to Thailand. I was like, what are you talking about? This is ridiculous. It was a ludicrous thing. Anyone? But he just went. He literally just went. And then 18 months, 2 years later, I was getting married, and my dad couldn't come to the wedding. And the reason he couldn't come to the wedding is because he was very working class. He was from Salford. He was a croupier in a casino. You know, so we're from a working class background. I'm from a working class background. And he felt that if he came to the wedding, he would embarrass me or shame me, because in his eyes, I now mixed with posh people. Gordon Brown was at the wedding. Other politicians were at the wedding. You know, people who work in our political world were at the wedding. And he felt that his drinking, and if he was there, it would be shameful and embarrassing for me. And so the day before the wedding, he told me he wasn't coming. And he wouldn't shame me. He was my dad. It's my dad. I loved him. And but I was also angry with him.
He didn't tell you that was the reason?
I found... He just said he wasn't coming.
Yeah.
I was so angry with him. You know, we had the, you know, even the place, you know, the name, the placemats on the, you know, for the table setting and all that, had his name on it, and there was a place at a table where he was supposed to sit and all that kind of stuff. so angry with him, but I knew it was sort of drink related. And then about two or three months later, he was dead. And I got a phone call. And this is, you go through such a weird rollercoaster of emotions. I got a phone call at 6 a.m. in the morning, and it was a Thai number on the phone. And I thought, oh my God, he's drunk again. He'll want to be sort of telling me the same old stories he tells. And I can't be bothered answering. It was actually the Friday before we were going to the Labour conference where you were elected leader ahead. Right. I listened to the voicemail, and it wasn't my dad. It was somebody else saying, please, can you ring? It's urgent. Of course, you have a weird premonition in my heart. I knew something like this was happening, and they rang, and he was dead. And he was 60. And then they said to me, and I sort of said, hardly able to get the words out, I said, was it drink related? And this person, not meaning to be casual, but just in the circumstances, it probably came across a bit casual, just said, you do know he was an alcoholic. And of course I knew, but to actually hear somebody say it out loud to me, it sort of was like being hit for six. So it's kind of heartbreaking, but it's kind of galvanised me to speak out on it and do something about it. And there's a charity I'm associated with, and I've now run two London marathons for this charity. I'm going to run the London Marathon again for a charity called NACOA, National Association of Children of Alcoholics. But I just thought, now I've got this role as somebody who could be the health secretary. And goodness knows, politics is so crazy at the moment. I mean, could be health secretary by the end of the podcast for all I know. given what's going on in politics, I thought, this is an agenda that I want to push. Yeah, you know, and do something about
it. And by conservative estimates, there are 200,000 kids who are growing up in Britain with parents who are alcoholics.
Yeah. I mean, that's some of the sector groups say it could be as many as 2 million. Others, like Public Health England, say it's 200,000. And many of those kids, I mean, I was lucky. He was a nice man, my dad, a loving man. He taught me a lot. He's where I get my socialist Labour beliefs from. You know, he would sit me in front of the television as a child and say, that's Michael Foote, we vote for him. That's Neil Kinnock, we vote for him. Things like that. So he was a Labour man. So I was very, very, very lucky in that respect. But there would be children today who, when they leave or when they left for school this morning, don't know what they're coming home to when they get home from school. And some of those parents with drink problems will also have drug problems. And some of those parents with drink problems will abuse their children violently or sexually. And those children won't necessarily know where to turn to, where to get help, you know, because the system sort of doesn't really at the moment help them as much as it could do. And that's the sort of argument.
What could the system be doing? I guess there's lots of changes, but what are the changes that...
Well, I mean, one of the things we've had a victory on, and there's a few of us in Parliament who've been campaigning on this, Liam Byrne, Caroline Flynn, we actually persuaded the Tory government to put some money into setting up a phone line. We actually persuaded the Tory government to put some money into a fund that local councils could bid for so they could put in place local support strategies. I mean, I remember a pretty robust, tough political fighter, you know, across the dispatch box and so on. But Jeremy Hunt, the previous health secretary, in fairness to him, was so moved by my speech, he actually rang me up and said, look, I want to do something. And then he announced, said he'll put some money into a fund. And then he actually said, well, what, do you want to announce it jointly with me? We actually did a joint announcement with him. I don't know if any other member of Jeremy Corbyn's shadow cabinet has done that. And it was a very awkward sort of TV interview of us both together, where because I'm quite short and he's quite tall... And we're stood next to each other. We sort of looked like the kind of, you know, that sort of John Cleese 2 Ronnie sketch. I looked down on him and it was a bit like that. And it's so, because he's so tall and I'm so short. I noticed, or someone told me, that when you like go to Google me And Google predicts what the next word might be based on the amount of people searching. Well, the next word when you go to Google Jonathan Ashworth is height. So all these people are trying to find out how short I was. But anyway, so we've made some progress. We've made some progress, but there's much more you can do. You know, we need to put proper support into schools. We need to put proper mental health support in for children in schools. But it's also,
and what does that support look like? Is it teachers looking out for signs?
Yeah. That kind of thing. But here's the crucial thing. This is where I do get slightly more political and sort of break the nice consensus that we've managed to develop. But the alcohol service treatment services in this country have been decimated. £162 million worth of cuts from drug and alcohol services. And you've now got a situation where people in need, people with a real alcohol problem, is at that some of the highest levels it's been for some time, over 600,000 people in need of some support, and the numbers actually getting any help have plummeted. And you've got like 1 million people being admitted to hospital for alcohol problems. You've got alcohol deaths higher than, you know, a particular high. So I've still got massive problems with drug misuse services. Mental health services have been cut back and are not, and you're seeing mental health providers, the hospitals and so on, closing their detox beds. So yeah, you've got all these problems in society, I think, where we're sort of not facing up to the huge damaging consequences of alcohol, and at the same time, government cutting back vital services, and actually, it's, and because I would argue, as a sort of as a left wing, you know, a Labour politician, that the broader austerity agenda creates poverty and deprivation and inequality, that's the breeding ground for further alcohol abuse as well. So this intervention the government has made based on our sort of lobbying is welcome, yes, and I'm very grateful and graceful in the way I've responded to it, but more, you've got to look at the broader picture.
Okay. John, thank you so much for joining us and sharing the story with us, and it's incredibly moving, so thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hurry into Menards and save big money. Stock up on water softener Salt for softer skin and cleaner clothes. Diamond Crystal is the perfect choice of salt to minimize water softener tank residue. It helps your soaps and detergents clean better while increasing the life of your appliances and plumbing. Save big on Diamond Crystal products at Menards. And don't forget to check out the flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Spin your passion into a business with Shopify and break sales records with the world's best converting checkout. Let's hear that one more time. The world's best converting checkout. Shopify's legendary checkout makes it easier for customers to shop on your website, across social media, and everywhere in between. Now that's music to your ears. Any way you spin it, you can be a smash hit with Shopify. Start your dollar a month trial today at shopify.com/records.
All right, with us now is Richard Piper. Richard, you are Chief Executive of Alcohol Change UK, and you're also sort of very involved in Dry January, which, I mean, that seems to me this year, more than even recent years where I've heard about it, this year everybody was talking about it.
Yeah, it's one of those campaigns that, yes, it's about individual and your own choice and your own empowerment, but it's also a campaign that absolutely starts a conversation, and we have a national conversation about it. I mean, this year, the amount of criticism of Dry January was really high. We love a bit of criticism. Every bit of criticism is another radio interview, and actually, most of the criticisms are misunderstood. But the campaign is really transformational. It's about long-term control. So the theory of Dry January really is, if you were to ask someone to kind of control their drinking for the longer term, and many people want to control their drinking for the longer term, they know they got a little bit out of hand, it's got you know, every weeknight, or they're associating it with every time they want to relax. They're finding themselves thinking about where their next drink's coming from. For people who want, you know, to make that change, how do you make that change? And, you know, the dominant discourse has always been, well, education, right? Give people knowledge. It just doesn't work. You know, we know that people don't change their behaviours because of knowledge. They change it experientially. So Dry January is an experiential 1 month, kick the booze for that month, give it a go, treat it like a training camp, treat it like a boot camp for you, treat it like an experiment. If at the end of week one you've got the shakes, go and get yourself to NE. If after week one you go, oh, I really need another drink, you've really learned something powerful. And if after 31 days you go, oh, that was easy, okay, cool, you probably were the wrong person for this campaign. It's really aimed at those heavier drinkers who want to get control over the longer term.
So it kind of gets people to take stock, and also by giving it a time frame as well, it makes you go through the practical experiment of testing your own relationship with drink. Because
that's a really good way to put it.
I think that's an interesting phrase, relationship with drinks. When people think of alcoholism, that feels sort of like such a down and out, rock bottom state that people don't necessarily identify with. But it's sort of about how functional or good your relationship with alcohol feels to you when you take stock of it.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, the word alcoholic, in fact, the phrase Alcoholics Anonymous, for all the great, great, amazing work that Alcoholics Anonymous do, that phrase is so much part of the public imagination. When you think of drink problems, you think alcoholics and you think anonymous, right? So anonymous, confidentiality, shame. There's got to be something there. And also this phrase alcoholic, I mean, it's very, very dominant in the US. It appears in the diagnostic manuals, etc. But in the UK and Europe, it's really problematized concept. Is there such a thing as an alcoholic? What is it? What defines it? Is it physical dependency? Is it psychological dependency? And actually, it's a really unhelpful term. Many people who want to get more control of their drinking absolutely would run terrified of the phrase or the term alcoholic. And we think it's just not brilliant term.
So I use it to shut conversation down. So I was saying to Angela before, back when I did used to drink and maybe I'd try and have a week off, I'd say to people, I'm having a week off, or I don't feel like one tonight. And people are like, go on, what's wrong with you? Or they'd be suspicious of people who just didn't want to have a drink. Whereas if I say, oh, actually, I'm an alcoholic, I've not had a drink in 18 years, people, oh, I better respect that then. You don't mess with that. But that sort of ties into the next thing we wanted to talk about, I guess, which is just the whole relationship with alcohol in this country and how we view it and just how much of a social norm or how equated with fun or giving yourself a treat or relaxation that booze actually is.
So, I mean, I think it's absolutely no secret that I suppose mainstream British society treats alcohol as the norm. And it applies to so many things, you know, not feeling good, feeling good, relaxing, trying to get up, trying to get down, trying to go out, not going out, drinking at home, drinking with friends, drinking alone, basically any opportunity. And of course, the alcohol industry absolutely plays a role in that. It has explicit marketing techniques, which it calls pretty anytime drinking. So any occasion is an occasion for drinking. And although no individual company potentially owns that concept, collectively, the alcohol industry markets that concept, some explicitly, some implicitly. But it's naive, I think, to just absolutely blame the alcohol industry. They're marketing into a culture that's already kind of very warm to that message.
And how much of a problem is it for the country?
Okay, so it's a big problem. So since 1970s, this is my lifetime. I was born in 1971, but I'm not splitting hairs. I can't do the math. But 50 years, let's say, we've got a 400% increase in liver disease. It's the only major health condition.
Jeez.
That's going up. Everything else is going down. Heart conditions are reducing. Right. Strokes are reducing. Cancers are reducing. Liver disease absolutely through the roof. And we're one of the few countries in Europe for which that's the case. Many countries in Europe have got control of this, but we absolutely haven't. And we arguably, we've been walking a generation or two into this crisis. And it's not, we're not talking here about 10, 15, 20, 30-year-olds. We're talking about the 50 and 60-year-olds, particularly the baby boomer generation, for whom alcohol was absolutely central to their identity. And I think identity is the heart of this issue. We talk about culture. what we're often talking about is a collection of identities. And I think those people who've had relationships with alcohol that haven't been healthy, I think pretty much everyone would be able to identify, and I speak personally, this, I still saw myself as, I'm a drinker. I couldn't perceive myself as anything but a drinker. The idea of not being a drinker, the idea of being sober, crazy concept. What a weird idea.
So are you completely sober?
I'm not completely sober, no. And I see myself, I call myself alcohol free. And what I mean by that is that I'm free from the trap that says I have to drink. And I have to drink because, I have to drink because of this, I have to drink because of that. I drink when I want to drink. I actually drink pretty rarely now. And when I do, I drink moderately. I don't like that phrase. I drink fairly sensibly.
We've heard from Angela, we've heard from John, both from the historical perspective and the sort of personal perspective. You've told us the scale of the problem. What's the kind of range of solutions that you'd be pointing to as the big things?
I've hinted there, I think, about personal empowerment. And I think it's so easy, right, to just say like, all solutions to all problems that rest with the government. And I fundamentally, I spent 25, 30 years in the charity sector, I fundamentally believe in the power of people to solve their problems as well, both individually and collectively. Collectively, everybody could just decide to stop sober shaming. Sober shaming is a phrase we use for encouraging other people to drink. And you'll have experienced that. I mean, everybody, everyone listening to this podcast, I think, will have experienced been encouraged to drink. Probably an awful lot of people will have been encouraging other people to drink. And I absolutely own up to being someone who I thought people not drinking was an affront.
You're
to
a
me.
Sober shamer.
Which I was a sober shamer. I'm like an ex-sober shamer.
It's like, I wonder if that's something that holds up to a mirror to people when they say that. But also it's acceptable to go, oh, I don't trust someone who doesn't drink. I mean, it's...
Yeah. My mum used to work for this guy who said he didn't trust men with beards.
I
was about 19.
Totally right on. I totally agree.
I'm sorry, Ed, you're wrong. But everybody can make that individual change. Today, we could shift British culture today by people just going, you know what, I'm never going to do that again. And it's actually not that hard. Once you spot it and learn to see it in yourself, you can spot it and to call it out in other people. But also, I think people who've got drinking problems. You know, it's fascinating that we shame people who don't drink. We also shame people who overdrink. There's this weird sweet spot in the middle that we're allowed to do. But let me also talk about policy and government, because I think there are solutions that can happen there. Scotland has introduced minimum unit pricing. Wales has also introduced minimum unit pricing. It's so not a silver bullet, but it does.
And that basically means that you can't charge less than a certain amount for alcohol. So it's particularly targeted supermarkets and so on. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of, it's hardly going to, it would have no effect pretty much on any pub because the prices that people, we buy stuff in pubs is already way beyond that price. We're talking about the strongest, cheapest drink.
And it is better if people are drinking in pubs and so on rather than at home or on...
To be honest, that feels a bit judgy.
Right.
we'd say so as an organisation not into telling people what to do or not what to do.
But anyway, but stopping it being stopping we bargain basement
we certainly booze love pubs.
From supermarkets would help.
I think the key is because it's minimum unit pricing, it's based on the unit of the drink. Yeah. So therefore it's a target measure based on the strength. And the strongest, cheapest drinks, we're talking the £10 litre bottle of vodka. We're talking about the white ciders, which contain the same amount of units, actually, as 3.5 litres, as that bottle of vodka, but for £3.79. We're talking pocket money prices. And these are the drinks that young people who are particularly those, and there's a big health inequalities issue here, by the way, younger people from certain communities and those who are experiencing serious drinking problems, they're the drinks these guys choose. They're incredibly price sensitive. They absolutely know what they're buying per pence per unit. And lifting the floor price of just those drinks.
So the floor price rather than the tax?
It's not a tax. It's just the floor price. In fact, one of the arguments against MUP is that the increased sales revenue goes to the companies. Although in reality, we expect the main approach to it would be what's called reformulation, where people just put less units in the drink, which is actually good. The aim of MUP really is to give more people longer life, because the more serious stuff you drink and the more strong stuff you're drinking, if you've got an alcohol problem, the higher your risk.
And you buy it, basically.
We think it's
a contribution.
We think it's a contribution. It should absolutely be introduced in England, but it's not the only solution. And if for whatever reason it was deemed politically unacceptable by any political party, we think there are other similar measures
what,
you could
what
introduce.
What would they be?
So, for example, there is a graph that shows the taxation and duty rates of all the different drinks, and it's the most crazy graph you could imagine. It's like letting your three-year-old draw a graph.
Yeah.
It's the most crazy arcane system that's been built up since about 1214.
So it should be it should be proportional to...
A simplified, sensible tax system based on the strength of the drink would be an alternative approach to minimum unit pricing. I think minimum unit pricing is probably more targeted, but you know, there's politics here, and I think we're in the business of finding solutions that work. We're not absolutely.
And what about advertising?
So I think alcohol marketing. Many people are shocked that we have independent regulators for the pricing of water. We don't have independent regulation of alcohol marketing. Who regulates alcohol marketing? You guessed it, the alcohol industry.
So you want what? Independent regulation?
We would argue strongly for a degree of independent accountability. Yeah. It doesn't mean it couldn't be through the Portman Group, but there needs to be an independent board there, or there needs to be an appointment that's accountable, essentially, to us as citizens. I mean, it's absolutely crazy. My daughters, 13 and 16-year-olds, I've given them a little experiment, which is to show me alcohol advertising that they're getting through Instagram. It's shocking. So my 13-year-old is endlessly being marketed to. I was talking to her the other day about Captain Birdseye. You know Captain Birdseye? She hadn't heard of Captain Birdseye. She's heard of Captain Morgan. She's not heard of Captain Birdseye. Okay, what's going on? So I think we as a society should just take control, absolutely, as citizens of alcohol marketing, and say we want alcohol marketing to be done in a sensible, fair way that doesn't push this. It is a drug, the most harmful drug on the planet. It's a toxin, it's a drug, it's addictive. We want that to be marketed in a way that's sensible and fair. I think that actually would be one of our key calls.
We have a thing on the podcast called the Jeffocracy, where I am supreme benign leader, very hands-off, will leave my various departmental heads and ministers to their own devices. So if I make you Minister for Public Health, specifically around alcohol harm, what is the first thing you do on day one?
Okay, day one, we'd fund alcohol treatment properly. We could do that. You could even do that just by putting up alcohol duty by the rate of inflation. So the freeze in it, i.e. the real terms cut in it, is enough to 100 million quid, we're talking, to pay for at least half of it. Put that up to 2% and you've covered
it. So there's a drop in the ocean.
It's a drop in the ocean. It's one of the most effective interventions you can make as a health intervention, because we're talking about kids who are living with parents who end up, if they're not careful, with abusive relationships. We're talking about domestic violence. We're talking about household fires. People don't think about household fires. We all think about household fire. It's a cigarette, right? A lot of people smoke and don't have a fire. Why do they have a fire? Because they fall asleep because they had too much to drink. Fall asleep on the bed with a lit cigarette. So 70% of domestic fires, 60% of domestic violence. We're talking about a societal wave, all of which can be prevented with effective alcohol treatment. People do not know where to go. They try Alcoholics Anonymous, and for some people it's an amazing experience. For other people, the whole spirituality bit is a massive turnoff. People think, okay, it's rehab, right? That's an expensive thing that Ant or Deck go to. What is the system? The fact is there's barely anything out there. And at the moment, it's stuck with drugs as well. So it's been collapsed with drugs. Recently, it's been taken out of the NHS, put into local authorities, collapsed with drugs. And many people who've got an alcohol problem wouldn't see themselves going anywhere near a service that's for people with drugs. And we get consistent feedback that people find that service threatening. And the ring fence that's currently been on that service, so it's a service that's been decimated and has a financial ring fence, that ring fence is about to come off. So those areas with lowest business rates, those areas with the greatest health inequalities, are those that are about to experience essentially destruction of alcohol treatment. So that would be absolutely the first thing I would do. And probably that could be busy for at least half an hour, to be honest, because you know there's a lot of things I'd have to be signing to make that happen. I'd have minions like you would have.
Yes,
yeah,
so of course.
You can be supreme, but I want to be demi-supreme.
And just to finish by giving us a reason to be cheerful, we started off by talking about Dry January. Can you just give us some of the numbers around the growth of Dry January? It's been extraordinarily popular.
So it started off with an amazing woman called Emily Robinson, who was training for a marathon, thought, I'm just going to kick drinking in January to kind of help me train. It started a few years later, we're talking about 5,000 people. This year, 4.2 million. That's one in 10 drinking adults.
That's extraordinary growth.
The key to regenerating, I suppose, as I said earlier, is this longer-term shift. And I am super critical about it. You know, my background is research evaluation, impact assessment. So I just like, I really don't want any programs going out in my charity that cannot demonstrate their effectiveness and aren't continually trying to improve. 72% of people who do Dry January, whether or not they complete it successfully in the dryness, they're just doing it, are drinking less 6 months later.
Wow.
So it's one of the most effective, because they've suddenly got this, and that's not just by having 31 days dry, yeah. That's people who sign up, who do the official campaign, who get the support. I am absolutely privileged to be able to observe and be part of, as a participant as well, for myself, are Facebook, closed Facebook groups, private Facebook groups for people who do Dry January. I could talk all day about the transformative stories. And I think probably if I was also allowed to be a minister of whatever I was a minister of, one thing I would do, I'd be publish one of those stories every day. I think that would give us all massive reasons to be cheerful.
That is a reason to be cheerful. Richard, thank you so much for joining us.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
What an interesting subject.
It really is.
You've thought about it a lot, I'm sure.
I have, but in a way, the thing that's made me think the most about our relationship with booze in this country isn't my own alcoholism. It's having an American wife move here and see the way British people are about alcohol and about how getting on an intercity train or an aeroplane is an excuse to go, well, hey, let's drink, even if it's sort of 9 o'clock in the morning. Or
And she's quite shocked by that.
Yeah, I mean, she's not a big drinker and she's not judgmental, but I mean, it's not that she's shocked. She's like, but she is, oh, the stereotype about British people and drink, it's really true, isn't it? Yeah. And in a way, I think you almost feel like a killjoy pointing it out, because it's something that's celebrated. And it's the word identity has come up a couple of times when we're talking to John. It's a way that we define ourselves sometimes as a country. It's seen as a national characteristic.
I mean, actually, what I quite liked about all of the guests in a way is that, you know, they weren't in a sort of, they weren't sort of preaching, you know, no. What I mean? It's all,
and I don't think anybody's talking.
It's
about
what Richard was saying about alcohol freedom, yes. You know, and the whole
the freedom
behind
the pressure,
Dry January, yeah. Giving proper treatment, sort of in a way helping people, because there's no point, you know, just saying we should educate people about liver disease is not gonna, it's not gonna do it. You've got to recognise the underlying causes and help people
and set people free from the pressure to feel like every time they go out they have to.
Do you still feel pressure to drink?
I don't feel pressure to drink. I mean, I can feel the impulse to, but I don't feel, I think, you know, as I was saying, I think it's easier to be me and to be able to say to people, I've been sober for 18 years, I got very messy on alcohol, than it is to be you going out with a certain type of friend to the pub and them saying, oh, do you want a drink, Ed? And you say, I'm just having a Diet Coke.
And would you couldn't have a drink?
No, I mean, no, it would escalate.
It would end badly.
It would escalate, yeah.
Email us reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Follow us on Twitter @cheerfulpodcast, or search for our Facebook page, Reasons to Be Cheerful Podcast.
Time for us to go now. I'm going off to see my wife sworn in as a High Court judge.
I'm coming too.
Yes, you are.
Yes.
You're a special guest.
And what
have they told you about your role yet?
Does she have her
You're own... holding the Bible.
Does she have a gavel?
Her own gavel.
Yeah.
Shit, I should have bought her one.
She's going to feel so foolish when she needs to bang the gavel and she's got nothing there to bang.
Yeah, no, yep. I think they probably get supplied with a gavel.
Right.
You could ask her. You could put your hand up when the Lord Chief Justice or whoever is doing the ceremony and say, do you get your own gavel?
There's not a bit in the ceremony.
I can be like, oh my God, it's my friend Jeff.
There's not a bit in the ceremony where they go, if anyone here knows the reason why this woman should not lawfully become a High Court judge, and I can say, yes, she's got no gavel.
Yeah, Ed forgot to buy the gavel. You've got to behave yourself.
I'm going to behave myself.
Yeah, I'm sure you're going to be very well behaved. You're a very good audience member, as I know from Iceland.
I am. And also, now that she is a High Court judge, at some point that means she becomes a dame.
She does.
Ain't nothing like a dame.
Yeah.
Which means you will become a...
Nothing.
You told me it was a Dan.
No, I think that's some kind of ancient ye olde English thingy.
Oh, I would claim it anyway.
Really?
Dan Ed Miliband.
Yeah.
I mean, it just sounds like you changed your name to Dan.
Yeah. But...
Exactly. But no, it's very exciting.
No, it is. I'm hopeful to get over there. So, shall we thank people?
Yes. So, thanks to Angela McShane, who was just fascinating on the history of alcohol in this country, to John Ashworth, Ed's colleague, who spoke very movingly about his father's relationship with alcohol, and to Richard Piper and all the stuff about Dry January and the way it's grown is really, I mean, it really is a reason to be cheerful.
Absolutely. So Emma Caution produced our podcast. We have a new researcher who we're very, very delighted with, Joel Pierce.
Yes.
Ed C did our music.
James Deacon
did our eye dance. Gail Lofthouse, recently ballroom dancing in Blackpool.
We've got a video to prove it,
is our announcer. And Emily Power did our artwork.
And that's it for this episode.
He's been Captain Birdseye.
He's been Captain Morgan.
These have been
Reasons to be
Cheerful.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.